One moment, please.
Okay.
Jeff?
Good morning, Modi. Good morning. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Beautifully.
Okay. We are at in a place called, with friends, a place called Lago Puelo. And we'll see how it works, huh? I don't know.
It's beautiful so far.
How are you?
Doing great. No, this is a this is a wonderful connection. I'm sure we're going to have a great interview. Are you ready to get started, sir?
Yeah, I'm almost ready to get started. But okay. First of all, I wanted to wish you a happy 4th of July.
Well, I don't have much of an attachment to America anymore, but thank you very much. Same to you, by the way.
I know, but still. Okay. And also, I wanted to realize that today it's a very special day in Argentina. You know why?
No, they won in the Copa Cup.
Exactly. In 1 hour, I mean, the whole country right now is just about crazy because in 1 hour at 6 o'clock, it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon here, by the way. So, and you've got it exactly right. The difference between, I checked it too. The difference is 11 hours. But anyway, in about an hour, right now, as a matter of fact, they are playing in the finals, Argentina versus Chile.
Chile, yeah, so I saw that.
It's a very special day in Argentina.
Well, I'm sorry you're missing it. I hope it's being recorded.
No, on both counts, I entirely agree with you. Okay. It's a milieu that we are living in, but I don't care. You know, it doesn't mean much to me. I'm a citizen of the planet. I have an affiliation to the planet, to the human race, and I don't believe in countries. I don't believe in religions. I don't believe in special religions. I don't believe in anything that. So I'm not. I don't care if Argentina. I think it's nice. It's our playing, but it's not important to me.
All right,
I'm just telling it to you, just as a.
And the United States women are playing Japan in the Women's World Cup final.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that's.
Yes,
maybe later
I have
on
a friend
today.
Who is following that World Cup, and it's. Yeah, I have friends who are watching it. Like, no, I don't even have. We don't have. I haven't had television now for 35 years, well, or 40 years. 35 years without television.
That's why you're so informed.
I hope so, but I'm trying. But certainly, I do not wish to be misinformed, and that's what television does for you, and also the commercials and
mainstream media.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So you got up at 5 o'clock?
Actually, 4:30.
Yeah, is that the usual way, or?
Well, I have to for interviews because it's the only time that. No. I'll probably go back and take a nap after that. Although I actually got 7 hours sleep last night, but I just wrote an article all day yesterday for the Saker, and so that's going to be going up in the next couple of days. And I'm editing my book, Reflections in Sinoland. I'm writing Xi Jinping's diaries, so I'm very busy.
Yeah, I can guess, but you're not working right now. You're on vacation.
No, my wife and I are on summer break. You know, we're school teachers, so we get off 6 weeks.
Now, just before we start, I hear you, but there are some interruptions. So,
well, you're not. It's coding. It's coming in yellow colored, which is not red, which is what we had last time. So it's okay. It's not perfect, but it's much, much better than last time. I don't think we'll have any dropped calls today. But if it does, I'll just call you back, okay?
Yeah, but what we can do, I don't know if you want to, if you have time, or Hans, my friend, the one who received the call, he says that Facebook is much faster. If you want to become go about it, you send me a friendship request, I accept it, and it shouldn't take a long time.
Yeah,
I mean, with your wife.
Unfortunately, I've been blocked from friending people for whatever reason.
No, I understand.
Reason.
But what about your wife's account?
Oh yeah, yeah. I forgot about that. She left and in fact, she went off with some friends this weekend. They're having a big party up in the mountains at the Great Wall. And I stayed here to work. Uh-huh. And I forgot. But then I have to make sure that I can record the call on Facebook because I'm using a special software called Skype to MP3. So I'd have to find a Facebook to MP3 software. So that was the next hurdle. Okay. I'd have to find a software for that.
Okay. But if during the interview, if there is a point where I don't seem to answer your question, it's probably I didn't get it.
Okay, gotcha.
Because occasionally, you're cutting out occasionally.
All right. Shall we go ahead and get started, Modi?
Absolutely. Let's go start it.
All right. Good morning, everybody, fans in Radio Sinoland. Out there across the planet. I'm very pleased to welcome back today Dr. Modi Nisani after our first interview covered the broad theme of the Fermi paradox and direct democracy. And we promised everybody out there a follow-up interview. And I have Dr. Nisani back on the line today. How are you doing, Modi?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. And thank you for inviting me to talk again on your show.
Really, really glad to have you. You know, we had hundreds of people listen to that program on 44 Days SoundCloud, and which was very exciting. And you even were inspired to write an article about our interview and expand on that. And you posted the article on Veterans Today and dissident voice, and I'll put those on my website.
Yes.
Can you please tell us about your article and how you'd like to fill in some of the gaps that we left off from our first interview?
Yeah, basically, and I have to thank you for inviting me because that was the inspiration for writing the article, which I wanted to do for a long time, but you know, so how things go, and I just never got around to it. So following the interview, I just, and of course, the article will have more substance to it because it's, you know, you can think down. And so maybe I should, if you would like to, just a few points from the article. And then what I would like to suggest is maybe you give us some of you, what do you think about the whole thing? And I'm sure you have some, you've been thinking about it
Absolutely.
For a long time.
Go ahead,
so,
Mel,
okay,
fire
so,
away. We're all anxiously waiting to hear you.
Thank you. Okay, the first thing is, that I added to the article is a point about specialization, and that we tend to accept experts as people that we should listen to. But what happens is that in today's world, that experts are experts in one thing, and apart from that, is something they call tunnel vision. So they don't see, most experts don't see the picture as a whole. And that's what I try to do in the interview, is provide kind of a holistic picture. Also, many of the experts, contemporary experts, are bought and sold. So if some of the ideas that we put forward, you and I, in the first interview, sounds a little bit odd, it could be that because experts are not telling the truth, many of them, and many of them don't know the truth because they are experts in one thing and ignorant about the rest. So that's one point I wanted to point out. The second point is that there are many warning signs that are surrounding us. If we just pay attention, most people don't, apparently. The world scientists, the Pope, even the Pope, imagine that. The Pope is saying that we are in deep trouble and that we have to change the entire system. And if we look around us, we find out so many things that are so many warning signs. That, for example, the air that you breathe right now in Beijing is not as good as it should be. Fukushima.
Sure.
That's for sure. Think of Fukushima. It could be. Some people are saying, oh, they are not telling us, but it could be that that Tokyo eventually will have to be evacuated. Think of the Gulf of Mexico. Think of everybody knows about the bees. The population is declining. It's all these are signs that something, yes, something bats, frogs. I mean, we have similar constitution to all these animals, and our DNA is not that different from them. They're going down. So it's a warning. Now, the main point of our interview that I was trying to make is that, you know, somebody like Guy McPherson talks about the global warming or climate disruption, and he says that by itself is going to be the end of the human race. Just that. Then you have somebody like Stephen Hawking talking about artificial intelligence, and he said that by itself and many others could be the end of humanity. Now, each one of these specialists is focusing on one problem, but the point of the interview was that if we take, and the point of the article too, okay, let's say that Guy McPherson, who is a scientist and ecologist, he knows what he's talking about. He says it's 100%, or maybe if you push him against the wall, he'll say the chances of extinction already, it's too late, are 99%. Stephen Hawking, I don't know what probability he would give to artificial intelligence eventually being our destruction, but let's say 5%. Now, if you go like that we went down the line and looked at all the planetary boundaries, all the point that could eventually be our undoing, nuclear war. What is the chance that it will take place, and then if it takes place, what is the chance that it will bring about human extinction? Let's say 5%. And the point of the interview was, if you take a holistic view of the situation, not just one or the other, but the whole thing, and then I came up, I mean, it's frightening, but I came up, when I did it, I didn't do it in interview, but when I tried to do it at home and look at all the points of risk at the whole picture, and also the risks that we don't know, that we'll find out later, but that could be dormant. We are not aware that they're a danger. And also, if we look at future technology, you take all of it together, and I came up with a more than 90% probability that humanity will go extinct within the next 200 years unless we do something. And, of course, something is collectively what our actions are. We are criminally insane. In other words, we are committing crime against our fellow human beings and against our only home, the planet.
Exactly, the pale blue dot.
Collectively, not you, not I, not your neighbor, but collectively, if you judge humanity as a collective, we are totally out of our mind. And so we need, obviously, and we concluded with that we need to find a way of somehow getting rid of the bankers, the parasites that control the world today and assert control of our lives. And of course, towards the end, my point was that, in my personal opinion, if the only way, if we are going to fight for a better world, the goal should be what it's called direct democracy. So that's more or less what, and then.
Well, it was a great article. I really enjoyed reading it.
Thank you. And most of the time, I really would be interested in some in your own reflections on what because you didn't get a chance to talk at all almost last night.
That's because you're so engaging.
Thank you. Okay.
Well, for our fans out there, let me just point out a few things. You mentioned bees. You mentioned honeybees. Albert Einstein, a physicist, was smart enough to know. He's actually quoted as saying that if we lose the bees, humanity would not survive 48 hours. And that's actually a quote from one of the most eminent physicists, who was much more holistic than people realize. And for everybody to understand, there's a lot of controversy about the honeybees, the populations have dropped about 25% and are continuing to drop around the world. And the consensus, the broad consensus is that it is being caused by pesticides and especially the pesticides that are used in agriculture. And so, again, those are man-made to pump up food production. And of course, Einstein is right. If we lose the honeybees, we lose pollination. We lose pollination. We lose agriculture, and we're all going to be dead, or starving to death. And next, frogs and bats. Frogs and bats populations are dropping precipitously in some areas, and slowly in other areas. And the obvious answer is, this one's less mysterious, is because of fungal infections. And the thought is that these fungal infections that have never appeared before are appearing now because of global warming, and because these animals have spent millions of years in a certain niche, which had a certain temperature. Now that temperature is higher, and it allows the fungus to grow on their skin and their bodies, and it's killing them terribly. Modi, you talked about specialization. Joseph Tainter, you know, the collapse of complex societies, that was one of his biggest arguments for complex societies collapsing, is because of exactly that, specialization. And we can now talk about specialization literally on a global level. And I think we have to now look at, not just the collapse of Easter Island or the collapse of the Mayans or the collapse of, the Han Dynasty in China 2,000 years ago, but we now have to look at the collapse of the entire human race as a holistic whole. So to me, Modi, now let's get to direct democracy. Here's, to me, the 800-pound gorilla in the room about the whole problem here is capitalism, because capitalism has done. You know, it's brought us penicillin and MP3 players, but the capitalism is driven for continual growth, for continual extraction, for continual expansion of markets, and for continual expansion of labor markets and everything else. And I mean, I haven't even read Marx and Lenin, and I haven't even read any of these books. But to me, that is where if we're going to have direct democracy, we have got to do something with capitalism. What do you think?
I entirely agree that the way you proceed right now, I don't know if, depending what you mean by capitalism, capitalism originally, the way I understand it, like something like in the city-state of Athens in Greece, that was capitalism, but that was the mom-and-pop stores like your bakery. I have no problem with your bakery across the street belonging to some to an individual. I think the problem is, talking about, it's not capitalism. It's kind of corporate. Gerald Celente talked about corporate fascism. That it's really the corporation, big corporation. It's not. I even remember going back to John Kenneth Galbraith, and the first time I realized that it's actually, are you familiar with the term oligopoly?
Yeah, oligopoly. A few
oligopoly, right, thank you. A few corporations are controlling the whole thing, but yeah, I totally agree with you. We have to clearly find a better system. But I was interested, you said that you met Kurt Vonnegut in...
You mentioned Kurt Vonnegut in our first interview, and the Cat's Cradle,
yeah.
and
Ice
Nine. And anyway, I recalled that I actually saw him. He actually came to Oklahoma City and gave a talk at Oklahoma City University in the early 2000s when we were living there. And he was such an amazing man, and he was such a wonderful speaker. He had tremendous charisma, and it was very interesting that he actually came to Oklahoma City. You know, it's not exactly a mecca of intellectual thought, and it was actually quite controversial. There were some people that were trying to prevent him from coming, and I didn't realize at that time just how radical he was in terms of his ideology. And I think he would probably agree with us that something has got to change. I agree with you. I agree with you. The baker, the barber, the plumber, the you know, the electrician, et cetera. And I think this gets back to one of the biggest hoaxes in the world is globalization. You know, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I remember reading articles back in the 2000s, how the Dutch, you know, quit growing cut flowers in Holland and started growing them in Kenya, and were, you know, growing flowers in Kenya and cutting them and putting them in refrigerated containers to fly to Europe to sell cut flowers, you know, in Europe, you know, and I'm just sitting there going, this is insanity. I mean,
yeah,
this is just, you know, so. To me, the first thing to do is we've got to scale back globalization, localize, and get back to it. You know, street markets and local markets, and think local, grow locally, produce locally, and get rid of the inanities of, you know, globalization, because it's just literally killing the planet.
Absolutely. I remember when I would just begin to understand what's going on. I was reading a book called Small is Beautiful. I forgot the writer. He was an Englishman. But are you familiar? Small is Beautiful. But anyway, the point he was making, here we have, I remember it's exactly what you're describing. We have a truck that's sending cookies or whatever from California to New York, and a truck that's sending cookies from New York to California. The whole system is. But earlier you made another comment that I would like you to follow up, and that's Papua New Guinea and Jared Diamond. What were they talking about?
We both agreed that most world leaders are psychopaths. And
absolutely.
That somehow you have to be in order to govern a country, because you have to accept a human suffering. You have to accept, you know, death, and you have to accept violence and feel no remorse. And that's the exact definition of a psychopath. And I when you were talking about that, I thought about Jared Diamond's work in his book Collapse, about the tribes there and how they were able to control the the psychopaths in their societies, and they call these guys the big man, and what the tribes will do is, obviously there are genetically among us some people who are more psychopathic than others and are more driven to dominate and to control, etc.
And are lacking conscience.
And lacking conscience, lacking remorse. Unfortunately, these are the guys that are running our planet. And in these hunter-gatherer tribes, which don't usually get more than a couple hundred people, and maybe that's where we need to get direct democracy down to, is that size. Is that if one of these guys pops up, they all give him a warning. They all talk about it right to his face. They all get in a circle. They all have a tribunal or a meeting and say, you are trying to take away our direct democracy. I mean, basically, these tribes in Papua New Guinea are direct democracy. They make decisions collectively. Some are more vocal than others. Some are a little bit more managerial than others, and some are followers, but it is generally equality throughout the group. And as soon as one guy starts showing psychopathic tendencies, they take care of the big man by giving him one, two, or three warnings. And after that, if he keeps it up, there are two options. They can either banish him from the tribe, kick him out, and push him out into the jungle by himself. Or if he doesn't go away, they kill him. And that is how they are able to maintain peace and prosperity within their tribe, is by controlling and weeding out these big men who try to take control of the tribe. And it's these big men that are the presidents of France and England and the United States and all over the world. That's what we're dealing with on a global level.
Exactly. That's just really beautiful. And that is what we need to do. We need to find a way of kicking out these guys. I remember I saw a movie once, many, many years ago, and it's about Inuits or Eskimos at the time they were called. And it's and some Europeans, they come, get stranded, and they're living with the tribe, with the people, but there is a scarcity of food. And each one of them, the locals, they accept them as their own. But they cross the line and they behave like psychopaths, and they take more for themselves, and eventually they drive them out of the tribe. Another example of exactly, and that's a solution for me. That's a question we have to ask.
Oh, hang on, we got cut off. It's going to reconnect. Modi, can you hear me?
Jeff? Yeah, I can
Modi,
hear you.
Can you hear me? Okay, great.
Jeff?
So you were so
I can hear you. Can you hear me? Jeff?
Oh yeah, I can hear you. I can hear you. I can hear you, Modi.
Yeah, I can hear you. That's for our listeners, if we are trying to actually form a connection between Beijing and rural Argentina. So and here the quality of the connection is not as good as it could be. So so are we? Can we continue?
So what? So what you were saying
point,
in this Inuit movie? They did
about,
this. Go ahead.
You're talking about the big man and how the tribesmen were handling it. Yes, that's the perfect solution. That's what we need to. I was trying to tell you a story about an Eskimo Inuit tribe that had exactly the same manner, and probably in all of them, you cannot have psychopathy, probably lack of conscience and irresponsibility are probably something like 5% of population. And we should realize that what the modern system is giving these people, if we can call them people, a tremendous advantage. If you're in a corporation, if you are willing to stab your competitor, if you're willing to kill him even, well, of course, you have, if you are Rockefeller, okay, Rockefeller is one of the most important guys, his descendants. How did he get to power? I'm sure you know it. He got to power by killing by killing his opponent, by doing anything he possibly could. Or the Russian oligarchs, the people, the billionaires who control Russia and Ukraine, they are criminals. They are not just, they are psychopaths. Almost all of them are men that you not want. So the question is, and we are going to talk about direct democracy, we should, it's interesting that they, Greeks, the ancient Athenians, had exactly the same mechanism that you're describing. They called it, if somebody came around and they didn't pose a threat to their democracy, they had a mechanism that they are, I'm sure you know about it, called ostracism. They asked, they didn't kill anybody, they didn't ask him, they asked him, Senor psychopath, you're posing a risk to our democracy, and we'll kindly ask you to get lost for 10 years. Right? You are familiar with that, right, Jeff?
Yeah, yeah, where they banish him. They banish them. Yeah, they banish them. Can you hear me?
They banish him for, they banish somebody, the poor. They didn't do it very often because it wasn't necessary. But it was, again, they had, it's just like the tribes that Jared Diamond is describing. They had a mechanism of unloading their psychopath. And they were just, for example, one of the people who got ostracized was the famous historian, Thucydides. And for 10 years, he was able to keep his properties, everything. But the people will get together and said and vote, and they exercised it very little. But so that should be, we have somehow, if we are going to survive, and if we are going to live in freedom, which we are losing, if we're going to have some kind of equality of wealth, if we are going to have peace, we have to get rid somehow. That's the key question for me. Before we go in political, that's the key. We are not going to have direct democracy unless we find a way of ostracizing the Rockefellers, how do you call that Ukrainian oligarch now that's ruling Ukraine, Poroshenko or something?
We have to find a way. Yeah.
I mean, people are disgusting. They are clearly psychopaths. How did he become a billionaire? I mean, just you don't want even to read about it. So unless we find Jeff,
yes, keep going.
Unless we find a way of somehow, and that's the a talk for another. But that's the key challenge to humanity: how the 95% of us who are not psychopaths, how do we eliminate these people? Because if we can't, and if we don't, then it's the end.
We're doomed. You know, you mentioned...
You wanted also to talk about, to say something about...
Hello, Modi?
Yes, I'm still here. I wanted to ask...
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you if you wanted to say something before we move on to direct democracy. If you wanted to say something about... And nuclear accidents. You're talking about Vasily when we talk privately about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Vasily,
yeah, absolutely.
You wanted to mention?
I wanted to. Yeah, absolutely. But I do want to point out that not only is it politicians, but it's CEOs and presidents and COOs and CFOs of corporations who are also psychopaths, because. You know, corporations gleefully kill people, maim people, poison people, by the millions. And so it's not only a political problem, but it's a problem with our economic system, too. Are you still there, Modi?
Absolutely. I mean, actually.
And so.
Yeah, I'm still.
And
there.
I did
Can
not
you hear
know
me?
That. I did not know that. Yeah, I did not know that Thucydides was actually ostracized. That's pretty amazing.
But and that's why, according to some people, he's. You know, we have. That's another thing that. Think about it. Think about the Athenians that we know. We know about Plato, right? The people who came after, they made sure to maintain the writings of Plato. But Plato was an enemy of the open society. He was, if you read his Republic, it's actually was an advocate of totalitarianism. Aristotle, the people, the genuine Democrats, we know them because of their achievements in other fields. For example, Democritus.
And it's not an incident that his name is Democritus, because his parents
they
believed in democracy. But Democritus, we know about him because of the atomic theory. We know that he was a great scientist. But we are not told, and his writings, and all the there were just as many. So history is selectively promoting one type. And also I wanted to say that I totally agree with you that actually what we have now, if you talk about government, we don't have government. What we have, the 465 congressmen in the United States, they are totally controlled by the corporation. So it's really
absolutely
sold. So that's where the power lies now, and especially the banks, especially the big bankers are controlling. So we really are living under a corporate state. The Obama, my opinion, is totally powerless. If he tried to, I don't think he has the intelligence to try anything. Or Bush, I mean, they're just not, unlike the Russian counterparts or Chinese counterparts, who are intelligent men. These are people are not, but they are not the government. The government is intelligent, and they are the corporate people who control. Obviously, for example, even going back to, I think, FDR, Roosevelt, he says in a private letter, I'm sure you're familiar with that quote, he's saying to some, you and I know that, I forgot exactly the wording, but you and I know that Wall Street have been in charge of
controls everything
since the days, and that's it, since the day of Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, exactly, with the big banks.
Yeah, so that's
when
Andrew Jackson tried
to take down the banks.
Yeah, we have a situation where we are live. It's a country for, by, and of the bankers and the corporations. And these people, to get to somebody like, what's his name, the guy from Morgan's, J.P. Morgan, how do you get to the top? You've got to be almost certainly a psychopath.
Yeah. Killing and maiming people and destroying lives.
Yeah, and destroying life and not caring. It's everywhere. Look what's happening to the Palestinians. This is the genocide. Look, the Iraqi people. Now they are not. It's not enough what they're doing in Iraq, Syria, and Palestine. They are now starting another war, and they're going to turn another
in Yemen.
They're going to turn, and they have absolutely no scruples. You're talking about the nuclear situation. They're out of their minds. The clock is at 3 minutes to midnight, and it doesn't stop them. They think, they're willing. So many accidents almost happen. They're willing to. For what? That's the only explanation.
Well,
that they are power hungry.
What I want to say is people don't realize that Russia and the United States still have thousands of nuclear warheads. And I wanted to point out that thanks to a couple of brave and courageous Russian soldiers, we actually avoided nuclear oblivion during the Cuban Missile Crisis. A soldier by the name of Vasily Arkhipov, he actually declined to pull the trigger to send an atomic bomb rocket to the United States, because he thought that the warning that he was getting was false, and it turned out to be true. But he was, according to protocol, he was supposed to actually pull the trigger, which would have definitely destroyed the planet. And then a guy by the name of Stanislav Petrov in 1983, again, another false warning that there were rockets coming from the United States, and that he again declined to pull the trigger. And it's amazing to think that the entire fate of humanity, was actually decided by the cool wits of two very you know, just normal human beings who happened to do the right thing. But what if they hadn't? I mean, that's, and we're sitting on thousands of these. I mean, literally thousands of these are installed across the United States on bombers and tactical bombers we've just gone from 25,000 warheads each, but we're still down to about 10,000 each. I mean, it's enough to, you know, blow up the entire solar system.
No, absolutely. And I want just to mention, to add to what you're saying, that that's what not the only new accident. Just a couple of days ago, a newspaper in Japan, I don't know if you read it, two guys were sitting, and they got an order to send one nuclear missile to Russia and three probably to China, and they declined to do it. There were many other incidents. There were Churchill wanted, as I told you the last time,
he wanted to bomb Russia.
MacArthur, the great general, and I'm being cynical, I'm sarcastic, wanted to bomb, to create a dead zone during the Korean War, and to bomb 30 nuclear bombs in China. The story goes on and on. There is no, eventually, what happens if, and there are other accidents, near misses, there are several well-known, documented near misses. We cannot be lucky forever. Eventually, some guy would not have the courage of Vasily Arkhipov, he'll push the button. And what happened there? During the Cuban Missile Crisis, have you read Bobby Kennedy, 13 Days?
No.
He described, I mean, those generals, yeah, we talk about Dr. Strangelove. These guys, they wanted to go to war. They wanted to push that, to push the button. Curtis LeMay,
yes, who ironically ended up being George Wallace's vice presidential candidate,
uh-huh,
in 1968. He was, uh-huh, the guy in Europe that developed the saturation bombing of the German cities to literally torch them. They took that model to Japan and to fire burn Japanese cities. And then that guy went on over to use the same bombing technique in Vietnam to carpet bomb Vietnam and kill 3 million people during the Southeast Asian War. So these guys, yeah, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they want the Bay of Pigs was supposed to be a false flag to enable the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They didn't want to just bomb Cuba. They wanted to vaporize Cuba. I mean, they literally wanted to send a rain of atomic bombs onto Cuba, and that's one of the reasons that JFK was assassinated by his own government, is because they were livid, absolutely livid, that he refused to nuclear bomb Cuba.
And we have to look at the record of these people. They are the ones who annihilated Hiroshima and Nagasaki totally.
Yeah,
totally needlessly, yeah, just to scare the Russians away. They're the ones. I was reading a few days ago, I forgot, an article about the bombing of, talking about Kurt Vonnegut. He was in a city that was totally destroyed. What was it? Dresden, I think. Totally destroyed.
Yeah, Dresden
destroyed.
Was 100,000 people, 130,000 or
and
something
they
like
did
that.
It,
literally vaporized according over two
according
or three
to,
nights of bombing.
Yeah. And it was totally...
Go ahead.
Totally unnecessary. The biggest Holocaust in human history, according to the book called American Holocaust, and according to him, the biggest Holocaust was against the Native Americans in North America. 20 million people dead in the most horrible,
absolutely,
deliberate. So these people have a record Another part of the equation, and I'm out of my league. I don't know if it's true or not, but a lot of people are saying that they have underground cities. For example, under the Denver airport, that it's a city below that. There is an underground city in next to Washington, D.C. So maybe, yes, and for me, it's very, very concerning, because maybe they think that they will just go into their bunkers, destroy the world, and then come out after 5 years, and everything will be okay. Because their behavior is so strange. It's so irresponsible, risking not only the environmentally, which is also, but that's longer, but risking a nuclear, an all-out nuclear war. They think that Russia is Yemen or Russia is Palestine. It's not. It has thousands, and it has nuclear delivery. And even some scientists are even saying that if you destroy Russia totally, that the nuclear winter will eventually take care of the United States too. But yet they can...
Well, the whole planet, Modi. I read a wonderful article that Paul Craig Roberts put on his website, an expert on nuclear war, and he laid it out. He said that it will not take thousands of bombs to destroy humanity. It would only take about a few dozen, and even if this whole idea of first strike, that the United States is going to be the first one to, you know, to land their bombs on Russia, even if they were able to do that, let's say they were able to take out the 10 largest cities in Russia,
yes,
we will go with, because remember, these bombs are not 25,000 kiloton bombs like Hiroshima and Nagasaki. These are megaton, multi megaton bombs that are exponentially larger than what was needlessly used in Japan. One of these bombs is equal to 50 or 100 Hiroshimas. And so even if they were able to get the 10 biggest cities in Russia, we're all going to die anyway because of nuclear winter. We will literally destroy. We will run. Food production will stop. Photosynthesis will stop around the planet, and we will literally go into Cormac McCarthy's book, The Road. If you ever saw that movie or read that book, about sort of
which
a
one
Holocaust.
Which one?
Cormac McCarthy's book, The Road. It was made into a movie with Viggo Mortensen. I highly recommend it. Anyway, it's a post-Holocaust hellhole where nothing is growing, agriculture has ceased, and the few remaining survivors are able to survive through cannibalism. And that's what we'll have, even if the United States succeeds in their first strike, because we will literally destroy photosynthesis, and we will destroy crop production, and the whole thing comes tumbling down.
Yeah, I'm not. Another book, by the way, that the one that I remember many, many years ago, On the Beach, where the
with the post-nuclear in Australia.
Yeah, in Australia, and how the cloud of cesium, radioactive cesium that had a half-life of, I forgot, maybe a few months or maybe a couple of years, is moving towards them, and they know that it's coming. I don't know exactly, the probability. Maybe some life or maybe human life can survive. Maybe if they go underground for 2 years and then coming out. Remember, if they do have the underground bunkers, and if they are well equipped,
but Modi, they have the underground bunkers. Of course, 9/11 was a gigantic false flag, and one of the things that they tested with 9/11 was what the United States has called continuation of government, COG.
Yes,
and they wanted to test continuation of government. That was one of the reasons, besides starting the world war against Muslims around the planet. They wanted to test continuation of government. they went into that bunker. You know, Dick Cheney went into that bunker outside of Washington, D.C.
What is it called? Mount bunker. Do you remember the
Mount something. It's Mount something. Yeah, exactly. You're right. Yeah. And I'm sure they have one in Denver. And I'm sure they have probably two or three. And, yes, these guys are willing to destroy humanity, literally wipe out the human race, hide out with their, you know, with their NASA meals, for, 2-5 years and come out and live with the cockroaches that have survived.
No, it's entirely possible. I wouldn't put it past them. That maybe that the most worrisome thing is maybe that's a plan. We don't know what.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I mean, it's so bad. It's so unbelievable that's what we have to live under.
Well, Modi, we haven't gotten any closer to solving the world's problems with direct democracy. How do we get there? That's the key. By the way, I wanted to ask you, you know a lot more about this than I do. We know that in Papua New Guinea, most of the, hunter-gatherer tribes were, anywhere between 50 and a couple of hundred people. And those were direct democracy, where they were able to get rid of the big men.
Yes.
The psychopaths. What were the size of the direct democracies in ancient Greece?
Ancient Greece, Athens, the city of Athens, the population was about 40,000. So that is manageable. You can even go, the one successful, I was going to talk about later, but the one successful place so far, unlike Greece that is caving in, but the one successful place where the bankers and their shenanigans were resisted, of course, is the island of Iceland, right? And the nation.
Yeah.
They resisted them, and they are picking up. And I think, don't quote me on it, but I think population of Iceland is something like 300,000. But, of course, the people there are highly literate, and they were able to, that was going to be one of my examples of the power of direct democracy. They were, the bankers, of course, wanted to take over and wanted them to enslave there. The people of Iceland,
like they're doing in Greece, with the vote today for the referendum.
Tomorrow.
Let's hope they vote no.
I just read an article about it. So the referendum tomorrow. But in Iceland, what they did, the key was exactly Greece is trying to repeat it. But Greece, I'm not sure, but some people like Engdahl and James Petras said that that the Greek government is really a phony government. It's not my opinion. I don't know what's going on. And they are saying that in that case, the finance minister is actually an Australian citizen. Right there, they lived in the United States in Australia for a long time. So they are already sold out. But to go back to the question of what's the size, it seems that 300,000, if you have a literate population, you can still do it. Athens, something like 40,000. So it's absolutely true. If we are going to have direct democracy, one way would be to decentralize and maybe to keep. If you're talking about the United States or France or China, is to keep a central government but with minimal powers and to divide the country, the states, artificially into small entities, maybe following the Greek example, it can be done. But even if you wanted to keep the United States as a whole, we have the technology. I was just reading the other day, I was reading an article, a book by the philosopher John Stuart Mill, writing in 1861.
I read him when... The social contract.
And he has a book. He has a book, Considerations of Representative Democracy, and he lists many reasons why direct democracy where the people govern themselves is the best system. So we have many, many reasons to believe, and what I was hoping to do is maybe just give, because most people, first of all, would you like now to move to the question of direct democracy? Are we ready for that?
Yeah, I would like to point out, though, is that I think you have to discount the size of Iceland because it is an island.
Yes.
I've always speculated that the only reason the Cuban Revolution, you know, the communist revolution there and the socialist revolution has survived since 1959, and that it has not been subsumed by Western colonialists is because it is an island. I mean, islands are, you know, England was, you know, invaded early on, but you know, even Hitler, you know, paused about trying to invade England.
Yeah.
And so, you know, islands afford you a tremendous buffer from outside influence.
Yeah.
I think that Iceland being an island, even though they are literate and everything, if Iceland were connected to Norway, I don't know if they could have done it, just because there's something about that land bridge that just makes it very easy for enemies of the state to, you know, penetrate bring down the system.
I agree. Iceland are just, you know, great, and they have that protection. Also, in both cases, Iceland and Cuba, you mentioned Cuba. I mean, we know, it's been documented, that the CIA tried to kill Castro for at least 100 times.
Oh,
I mean, they tried
50
every
times.
Every trick, and they would have, if they could, they would have killed the president. What happened in Iceland is they had a president who said, no, I'm not going to bail out, to transfer the wealth of my people to the English bankers without asking my people if they feel like saving,
enslaving themselves,
feel like donating the Rothschild and Rockefeller families their money to. So he carried out a referendum once and twice, and they would have, if it weren't an island, they probably would have killed him. I think that one explanation for what's going on in Greece, they remember the past. They remember that the CIA arranged a dictatorship there. Since 1945, Greece was one of the places where the CIA was extremely active. I remember being in Greece in the 60s, and there was fear on the faces of the people because they had a junta that. So they remember it. They remember the Greece. Even if they are
the
not
fascist juntas.
Yeah, even if they are not traitors, think for yourself. You know, if you know about Castro, if you know about Lumumba, if you know about the entire Kennedy clan, if you know that these people, John Lennon,
yeah, who've been wiped out,
there's people, if you defy them, if you defy the bankers, they will kill you and organize a color revolution or whatever. So it's not that simple. And you're absolutely right that Iceland, because it's a homogeneous society and because it's an island, and they have a protection. And Cuba also, another element is that you have to understand who you're up against. And Castro, Fidel Castro, if my memory is not deceiving me, he was present in Guatemala when the CIA organized the fascistic...
Oh, our bands.
Exactly. And he was... So Castro had a first-hand experience with American fascism. He knew that these guys... He knew he was clever. He was an educated man. He knew that these people, whatever they say, the movies, the propaganda, the New York Times, it's nothing. He knew that they are just as vicious as anybody the bankers of Rothschild, the people who really control, they are willing to do anything for money and for power. So he had no illusions, and he was prepared. He had the intelligence and the experience to anticipate. And also, that's a little bit out of the way, but also he was lucky enough for the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he had the agreement between Russians and Khrushchev and Kennedy was, okay, we'll get out, but you are not going to topple the Cuban Revolution. So that
it was
a combination of factors that say, but to go back to direct democracy, yeah, I agree with you. There's no reason. We can have, the best would be totally decentralized. But if people do not want to break it up, we have the technology now, at least for a referendum. Okay, they want to go to Iraq, let's ask us. They want to have the pesticide, like the Monsanto pesticide, let's ask us. And for example, you put every decision, do we want, and it should be automatic, that the government, the point of direct democracy, one of the points of direct democracy, is that the government is powerless. It's every decision. The Greeks, the Athenians, they will get up once a month, or I don't know exactly, and they'll in a place called not the Acropolis. Near the Acropolis, there was a place called, I don't know how to pronounce it, PNYX. And that's where they will get together, the entire people, and they would vote on anything that they felt like. That is direct democracy. And other aspects of direct democracy, we have a judicial system. But who is the guy or the lady who is really controlling what's happening in a courtroom? It's a judge. Have you been on a jury?
No.
Have you served on a jury? Well, I did. I twice, and my wife, Dana, also have been a couple of times. And the judge has tremendous influence on what's going on. Well, the Greeks, the ancient Athenians, had a remedy for that. They knew that a judge is an agent of the bankers, really, after everything is done. The people, it was a judge-free trial.
It was a jury trial with no judge, totally
jury trial. There was the head of a jury, and you appealed. It wasn't what we have. It's better than what Argentina doesn't even have jury, but in the United States, the idea. But the judge is in charge. If you want a democracy, you have the most famous trial, and of course, it's written by the record of the trial, it's written by an enemy of democracy, so the people are made to look bad. That's a trial of the philosopher Socrates. But if you remember in the Apology of Socrates, or in Greek, the Apologia, if you remember the trial, if you remember when you read about it, there are 500 Athenians. 500 is 5% of population. They are sitting, there's no judge, and they are the ones who have to decide what to do with that renegade Socrates, who was unlike what they are telling you. You know, he was a martyr of democracy. No, he wasn't. He was closely associated with the tyranny. He was maybe personally not, but he was. Most of his students were the people who betrayed Athens in its war against. That's why they put him on trial, because he was Alcibiades, for example, Critias, the main tyrant of Athens. He was one of his close associates. But anyway, the point is that another example of what democracy. That's what democracy is. I'll give you another example. In the United States, which is not a democracy. Democracy means people rule. The power. Power to the people, as John Lennon put it. Power to the people. The people are sovereign. As John Stuart Mill wanted them. People are sovereign. So in the United States, they're telling us a democracy, but it's not. One example, if anybody has any doubts, besides everything else, besides the Sunshine Bribery, the assassination, besides the information that they control, brainwash our minds, but if anybody has any doubts, I used in my class, I used to do to carry out that experiment. I would have a plate, and I would tell them a story about Mr. David Rockefeller. What happened? And I tell them that you just send a letter to Wayne State University and ask us to act as agent. And I would do it in the beginning, so they didn't know me and they thought that I was telling them the truth. I'll tell them, okay, David Rockefeller. I wrote a letter to my university, and he asked him for his help. What happened? He has only 49 yachts. On the other hand, Evelyn Rothschild has 50. And okay, and what he needs, he just cannot afford the 50th, and he needs the people's help. So I'm going to pass, and I'm serious about it, and I'm really expecting you to help me out. And I'm going to pass a plate, just like they do in church, and I ask you to, from the bottom of my heart, to put some, to donate for his 50 yard. And my students look at me, first of all, as if I was out of my mind. And then they, then I pass the plate, and nobody, just imagine it, nobody donated as much as one nickel to the Rockefeller Fund.
Yacht.
Okay. And then I present them with the moral of the story. And I tell them, of course, it wasn't real. The moral of the story is, if you take the United States as a whole, think about it. 50% of the people, I don't know, correct me if I'm mistaken about the statistic, but as far as I can remember, 50% of the people have only 1% of the wealth. When Reagan came to power, that was not good enough for him. He asked us to do exactly that. They call it tax cut to the rich. That's what all presidents since Reagan have been doing. They took money from you and I, especially from poor people, and gave it to the Rockefellers. That's what's happening now.
Of course.
And they are telling us that's a democracy. That is not a democracy. It's inconceivable in a democracy that 50%, let's say we're an island of 100 people. Let's say 100 people, 50 of them, and one person owns 40% of the island and the wealth, and 50 of them own only 1% of the island. That's exactly the situation. The cockroaches of David Rockefeller are eating better than they do. And let's imagine a democracy. They get together next to the Acropolis over there, and they're looking at we can vote whatever. If democracy means we can do whatever we want. The first thing that they will do, hey, let's divide the wealth, if not equally, but it's not fair that the cockroaches of Mr. Rockefeller,
are eating
better than my children. What, is that a democracy? Of course it's not a democracy. So, and that's what happened during human history. That's what, of course they were not. It's not just, it's not fair. It's obscene. That kind of that we have people dying of starvation on one hand, people living in the street, and that guy, it's not. I mean, what do you do with billions? The only thing you can do with billions of dollars is corrupt. So it's another example and in Greece, of course, when they went to war, the rich people have to provide for the triremes, not the poor people. Poor people by the service. And there are many, many aspects. And the reason there are many reasons why, you know, we have been, like everything else, we have been collectively brainwashed against it's real democracy.
Well, we've been brainwashed against our own interests.
Against our own interests, and we've been brainwashed to believe that from the cradle they are talking about mob rule. But if you look at Athens, if you look at the Papua New Guinea, it's the opposite of mob rule. It's working very well. So that's one why people, when you talk to them, and most people, they are kind of let me cover what I feel are the psychological. Why psychologically people are so reluctant to accept it. One of them is the propaganda system. We have been told over and over again that it doesn't work, but it's not true. The second one, because historically and philosophically, we have many good reasons to believe that it does work. The second reason why so many people are reluctant to accept the fact that real democracy is the best political system there is, and it's certainly better than the joke we have now, is the opposition of intellectuals. And Plato. Plato was an enemy of democracy. Or Thucydides, for example, and many, many, what they've done for us throughout the ages, they elevated somebody like the philosopher Hegel. He was an enemy of democracy. So they selectively throughout the ages, they elevated the people who are not friends of democracy and suppressed the real, for example, look at the American Revolution. Okay, you have on one hand, you have Washington, the richest man at the time, United States, and I'm not denigrating him. He was, for his time, for a rich man, he was pretty decent. But so we have a state of Washington. We have
Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C. But whoever, Thomas Paine, the greatest Democrat of
Franklin, of course.
Or even Franklin. Franklin has done much more. According to most military historians, George Washington was really not a very good general, militarily speaking. It was Lafayette that actually won the war. But forget about that. A second. So if Lafayette won the war, the man who convinced the French to help the Americans is really the man who should get the credit. It's Benjamin Franklin. But we don't have cities because Benjamin Franklin was more or less a genuine Democrat, Thomas Paine. So selectively throughout history, there have been a concerted effort by the oligarchs in all ages to make light of the potential, because that's the greatest, the biggest enemies to the Rockefellers is direct democracy. Once we get, once you and I and our fellow citizens assume control, forget, even it's true, small size will be better, but we have the technology now. If they ask us every time, they'll say, okay, every 100,000 people can put whatever we want. How about we just say that you cannot have more than $10 million. I think it's a great idea that nobody should be allowed to have $10 million. Nobody should be allowed to corrupt. That you should stop the. How do they control us? They control us by bribing and pre-selecting our presidents right now. Really, I mean, this is a joke at our expense. Clinton and Bush, another time, are they kidding us? But how do they do it? Because they have so much money. So if we could have, despite the propaganda, if we could have direct democracy, things would be extremely different.
One of the, and something's got to change because, you know, you talked about even in the United States, remember last year, Vermont voted to put a genetic modified organism labels on all GMO food products in Vermont.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
And what happens? The corporations, the Monsantos, and everybody else, and all the food processors come in, spend millions and millions and millions of dollars, you know, paying high price lawyers to clog it up in the judicial system, and it will take 20 years for the decision to be made. And in the meantime, they get to continue to sell GMO unlabeled in Vermont.
Exactly. Oh, tomorrow. Look how scandalized are the bankers. They call them the Troika, but it's really private banker was standing behind all things. Look how scandalized it is that the Greek democracy, the Greek of all places, the birth of democracy, or one of the places where it's born, that they have the gall of asking the Greek people, what's their opinion? Do they want or not want? But let me give you, you know, the idea of direct democracy. I wanted to talk about something a little bit apart from politics, because I think direct democracy does not only apply, and it's not only attractive for organizations as well. I think we should in factories. I think we should have direct democracy too in schools everywhere. Let me give you one example that captures. There is, and it's coming from music. According to some people, the greatest orchestra, I'm talking about music, the greatest classical orchestra in the world, do you have an opinion about it? Do you have a favorite?
No, I love listening to classical music, but I know, you know, there's Berlin and there's Moscow and there's San Francisco.
Stop right here. The first one you mentioned, and I'm We didn't work it out. You just mentioned it yourself. The first orchestra you mentioned was the Berlin Philharmonic. Now, what is unique about the Berlin Philharmonic? It is direct democracy. It is a direct democracy. It's, somebody says, I'm going to quote to you because I want, it's so important for people to realize that they can, to be self-empowered and to realize that democracy means the real democracy. Direct is just really not necessary. Democracy, not the joke that we have, but how it is. Here's one commentator. I'm going to quote to you a few of his words. First of all, he says the Berlin Philharmonic, and that's democratically governed, is the coolest band in the world. And he says, now I'm quoting, I have a quote ready. When the Berlin Philharmonic was created in 1882, its 52 musicians decided to do business differently. They wanted a democratic system that not only involved the musicians, but empowered them as well. It is the musicians who manage themselves from scheduling concerts to making tour arrangements or handling delicate personal matters. The audition process is totally inclusive. And he goes on to say, the last time I saw the Berlin Philharmonic, I thought it was the greatest orchestra I'd ever heard. I thought that the time before too, and the secret, it has to be. The secret, again, when people govern themselves, is think of it. If I am part of a cooperative, like a kibbutz, if I'm part, I feel I'm not working. If I'm working a factory for GM, or I'm playing, I have a lot of musician friends, and they are alienated. They are alienated. Or in university, a lot of us, the academics, the professors in my university, feel alienated. Why? Yes, we have certain degree of freedom, but the people in charge are the administrators, the people who are encountered for the politicians. Just imagine that we could have something like the Berlin Philharmonic. So the point is that the direct democracy is just, it's so simple. It works so well. If you look at hunter-gatherers, our ancestors, they were happier than we are. They were happier because they were, most of them, the Athenians. If you ask me, where would I rather be born, be a part of? Let's say someplace up there in the sky, you're given a choice. Where would you? I would rather. I like reading too. So Papua New Guinea would not suit me because I like also the intellectual life. So, and the Iroquois Confederation, which was wonderful too, in some ways superior to the Athenian democracy. But for me, if you had to ask me, and absolutely, of course, there are disadvantages. I mean, women were not allowed to participate. They had slavery. But of course, we could change it. We can make it all encompassing. Yeah. Our direct democracy would include everyone. So if you ask me, where would I prefer? Of course, I would prefer to without air conditioning, without cars, without whatever it is that we have. But it's not superficial things. It's the community, the creativity, the self-sufficiency. They were economically, each Athenian household, they understood that printing of money. Okay, here we have, they control us partially by printing our money. Well, in Athens, it wasn't the bankers, the so-called federal debt, the bankers, the Rothschilds and Rockefellers are printing our money and controlling us. But over there, it was the state created money, and it wasn't just fake green paper, but it was silver, because they had silver mines. So yeah. I would have certainly chosen. So for me, kind of to conclude, that part of our discussion. For me, the ideal is direct democracy, and the means to do it is your approach. Somehow, and that's complicated, that's the biggest challenge of somehow we've got to get rid of the psychopath. We've got to find some way of unloading them. We are, as Marx said, and many others said, we are many and they are few. There got to be a way, I think, well, I hope. If not, then it's over for us. But there got to be a way of somehow, maybe by doing what you're doing, you know, just trying to appeal to people. But maybe it's
one of the ways. Remember, I sent you that article, the link, and I'll put it on the website.
Uh-huh.
It was in the Guardian. It came out on Labor Day, May 1st this year, about how employees of companies around the world that have been shut down by, you know, the greedy owners. Because they can make money elsewhere, or they can, you know, do better doing something uh-huh. else, and leaving these people unemployed and penniless, they're taking over their businesses. They're literally going in and assuming control of these businesses that were going out of business or actually went out of business. And so they created cooperatives, and they had some wonderful examples. They had Turkey, they had Greece, they had France, they had Spain, they had Argentina, which actually was a huge business. They're in oil storage, petroleum storage, and that's now employee owned. And so that was that article gave me a lot of hope. And apparently, Spain and France are at the vanguard of this. Spain, about 75 companies a year are being taken over by their employees, and in France, a few dozen each year. So maybe this is a model also that because we got to eat, we've got to put, you know, clothes on our back, and we've got to put a roof over our heads, and we've got to educate ourselves. And so, and it does take money. We've got to make something. We've got to do something to. And of course, what I love about the article is every one of these were localized. They were, you know, taking care of their local community first. And I think the in Greece they started to do some, you know, exporting some of their products, you know, into Europe. But the number one concern was to. You know, think locally and provide a life for themselves. So that's also maybe a possibility on the economic side. These employee stock ownership, you know, plans or, you know, co-ops, along with some sort of a democratic political system on a local level.
I hope you're right, and it's possible, but I think we have. Many of us have a tendency to underestimate our enemies. They are very clever, and if you look at our lifetime, they've been winning for a long time. Let me go back to Greece, and because that's, for me, that's the solution. What happened there? There was a Peloponnesian War. It lasted 30 years. And at the end, the Spartans, the totalitarian Sparta won. That's the way, according to Karl Popper, that's the way, and that's truth. That's the way we are led to believe that the Spartans won. But that's not the truth. What happened after the war, the Spartans, just like the Americans now, established a horrible dictatorship. Plato's uncle, Critias, was the head of the dictatorship, and they proceeded to decimate the Athenian population. And the Athenians, they were people who were raised in liberty, and they had a choice. They could try to somehow work with the tyrants, but they said no. They believed, with Pericles, who was one of their leaders, that the only way that you can protect yourself from tyrants is to give them a bit of their own medicine, revolution. Thomas Jefferson, too, I'm sure you're familiar with the quote.
Oh, absolutely.
The tree of liberty, he says, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember exactly, must be nurtured from time to time with the blood of tyrants and patriots. And I believe But to go back to Greece, okay, so they started a small group, and unless you really made it your business of studying Greek history, you don't even know the names. They are heroes. They started with a small group, and they started at one place, and within eight months, they reconquered Athens, they reestablished the democracy, and to the point where Athens and the democracy, the entire Greek world, believed that it was invincible, and they stayed in power, the democracy, for decades until Alexander, the dictator, the great dictator Alexander, Miskol the Great. He was not great at all. He was a parricide. Yeah. He was a dictator, and he was power hungry. He belonged to the same group of people that are now. That's how they. I refuse to call him the Great. He was Alexander in my book, the Little, but he was. He started by killing, most likely killing his own father. Just imagine. What's the mania of conquering the whole world? Is he out of his mind? What's driving him? What's the matter with this guy? But he's the one many decades where the democracy survived. It survived because the people, as Pericles says, you want freedom, you've got to be willing. Freedom takes, or Jefferson. So I think maybe it will work, but I've seen, you know, I've studied the history of these people for centuries. They are willing to do anything. They have a plan, and they are bent on achieving total control of us, enslaving us, robbing us of what is ours, having perpetual wars as in 1984, and it could be. And for me, I know it's not palatable, but I don't see any way. If you want to get that, the goal is direct democracy, but they're not going to let us do it. They will stop every time anybody tries to do something like that, like in Iceland or Greece. The people voted; they're gonna win in Greece, one way or the other. They will bribe the politicians, kill them.
Greece has never been out of the control of the CIA since World War II.
Yeah.
The Gladio army, the secret army, you know, the NATO secret armies, Gladio. If that referendum passes, I will pass out. I mean, I don't think it'll happen. I think they will. It's going to be rigged, no matter what.
Exactly. So
I don't think.
But I think.
I don't think Greece has had any freedom since World War II.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you entirely. But it shows you the strength and the how astute and how clever these people are. They don't have a conscience, but they do have a plan, and they are intelligent. And I think the only way, tragically, that is the tragedy of our contemporary era, that it sooner or later, and I will have to give them to fight back. I don't see. Okay, no. These are experiments of direct democracy in Iraq. The Kurds are trying it, Iceland, but these are isolated. I remember reading a long time ago a book by Huxley, Island, and You can do everything the right way, but they'll eventually come and destroy you. And the only way, for me, we have to figure out a way how to go to the city of London, the little, and how somehow to disempower Wall Street, how somehow to eliminate their power over us. And I don't, right now, everything else seems to be failing, and I'm, tragically, and I don't want to do it, and I don't know if it can be done either, but the only way out I see is fighting back.
Yeah, well, to paraphrase Mao Zedong, China's leader after liberation in 1949, you know, revolution or change comes, you know, from the barrel of a gun, and unfortunately, that's what history shows time and time again. The only way that effective change happens against tyrants is is revolution, as you say. You just people have to just, you know, that's the one thing they fear. And that may be, you know, that may, you know, it, with all due respect to Mahatma Gandhi and all due respect to Martin Luther King Jr., who were for peaceful, you know, peaceful resistance, which I think has a very, very important role to play. But they were both shot.
Exactly.
They both got assassinated. By the state.
They both and many others were shot by the state. So you can't. There is a quote somebody said to Martin Luther King: "This non-violent business is going to kill you." And that's exactly what happened.
Oh,
and
sure
many,
did.
Many. You can go all the way to Jesus of Nazareth. He also tried nonviolent.
He was also shot
because they're willing to Kennedy and so many others. How can you fight somebody who is willing to kill his peaceful opponents? Occupy, even something as innocuous as the Occupy, there are documents showing that somebody. The FBI would not tell us who it is. It's probably them, but somebody had a plan of assassinating the Occupy leaders. So how can you, how can you fight? And forget about the Black Panthers, for example. How many of them have died?
Yeah.
Union activists. How many? Joe Hill and Big Bill Haywood. How many of them?
Malcolm X,
or think about somebody as gentlemanly as Eugene Debs. They put him in prison.
Yeah.
Okay, in this case, they didn't kill him, but it's almost the same thing. They put him in prison because he was opposed to a war that was fought for the Rothschild. The World War One, United States had absolutely no business, and the American people, until the propaganda machine got going, they were opposed to it. When you are faced with somebody who is willing to do anything, or look at what they've done to Iraq, I mean, this is a genocide. Totally, everybody knows that all the excuses that they use were just straight out lies. My question is to everybody, to those of us who are aware of what's going on, who care about humanity, who care about children were dying needlessly. At what point do we say, basta, we are not going to accept it anymore?
Enough is enough. Enough is enough.
Enough is enough. 2 million Iraqis are not 2 million. We didn't anything. They are just a victim of 2 million Iraqis. How many Syrians? How many Americans? How many Americans are sitting in prison because they dare smoke a little grass,
marijuana,
and the failing justice system. At a certain point, we'll have to. Unfortunately for me, that's only. I don't know how to exactly go about it, but I think it's something that we need to think about because we have the future of humanity,
the human race
at stake.
Well, Modi, I don't know if we solved any of the world's problems, but we sure had a good time and a fascinating and a stimulating time talking about it. This has been a wonderful interview on Radio Sinoland, and we'll have to get back together again. I will put. I wanted to suggest to you before we leave. Why don't you put an article on Dissident Voice, so that not everybody's going to want to read Plato and Pericles and Thucydides and Socrates and all that. Maybe do a 4 or 5 page summary of a brief history of Greek direct democracy. I think that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
From the very beginning until Alexander the Great. I think that would be a wonderful thing to follow up on. I will put your links to Veterans Today. I will put your links to Dissident Voice on my website,
www.44days.net. I wanted to make clear that I actually was going to do all that. I've written the article already. It's already posted in Veterans Today. The reason for that, but
okay.
I will add our interview to the article itself. But the reason for that... I know it sounds naive and a little bit stupid maybe, but I wanted to post the article before the Greek plebiscite.
The referendum.
And I know there's nobody, only a few people are going to read it, and it's not the Greek people, but somehow I felt an urgency to put the argument for the Greek people, to teach them, to tell them about the history, and to tell them that they should think about it, and they should, because it seems to be, so I already, but what I'll do, I'll just add the link to our conversation to that article.
Well, unfortunately, there's another famous quote by a famous leader, Joseph Stalin, who said that it doesn't matter who votes. What matters is who counts the votes.
Absolutely.
And what I'm afraid is, even if they vote for the even if they vote no, they're going to. I mean, everybody knows, John F. Kennedy was put in, and thank goodness was put into the presidency, because they came up with 50,000 fictitious votes in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
So he took Illinois and beat Nixon. Uh-huh. So I mean, elections are. Historically very, very corrupt, which is another reason why we need to get back to local democracy, direct democracy. It's just been a fascinating conversation. Let's do this again in the future, and wonderful to have you on. You're a very deep and broad thinker, and I think we make a good team as far as stimulating discussion.
And I wanted to thank you again for inviting me. And yes, let's do it again. And I enjoyed our conversation as well.
Well, enjoy beautiful Patagonia. The vote in Greece is tomorrow, so maybe you can get your article posted before tomorrow.
No, it's already posted.
Okay. Well, send me the link and I will put it on my website.
Okay. Okay, great.
Okay.
Have a wonderful day.
Well, hugs to you and your wife, okay. Donna, and from Beijing, and we'll get together soon.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.